I'm privileged to be joined by two fellow Scandinavians, Stefan Gustafsson and Espen Ottosen, and my own name is Lars Dahle, and we will focus on a very important area strategically, and that is how we are involved and how we relate to, in a both proactive and reactive way, to the mainstream media. And I'm privileged to have two experienced opinion writers with me. Stefan works in this area in the Swedish context, and Espen, you work in the Norwegian context. And of course, that works well then for me, who is a citizen of both countries, so that helps. So in any case, let's start by putting this into a broader picture. In the Lausanne movement we've been working on, in the global evangelical movement, how to understand the media engagement. How do we engage with media in different ways, in different levels and ways? And one of them is called media presence. Well, we can call it a calling to public witness and integrity. And this is a quote from an article, in this case, in fact, written by me in 2014. And it says, there is a wide variety of legitimate and strategic media roles to explore within the general media world for talented Christians. Journalism and documentary work reveals neglected facts, stories, and angles, which enables a more balanced public and private debate. Creative and entertainment media can present new and fresh ways of imagining Christian truths, which may generate genuine interest in significant moral and spiritual issues. Through the presence of skillful Christian communicators and apologists in mainstream media, the credibility and plausibility of the gospel and of a holistic biblical worldview may be commended to skeptics, seekers, and to Christians. That is the wider context of being involved as opinion writers, as commentators in the mainstream media, that there is also a place for journalists, for documentary work. There is a place for creative entertainment media work. But that's not the focus of our session now. But I think it's important to see that the calling, the topic, the area, the field belongs to a wider context. So then the question comes, how do we, why do we want to write opinion pieces in mainstream news media? Well, we communicated, the three of us, on beforehand, and I think this was you, Stefan, coming up with some key ideas. Four major reasons as Christians. Well, one is to comment on a recent discussion. There is a need to comment in one way or another on a recent discussion, event, or development. Then there may be a need to clarify something. Questions, alternatives we are facing, and implications of different views or choices or worldviews and so on. And then thirdly, to introduce a Christian worldview perspective into a larger discussion. And then fourthly, to increase the audience's knowledge of a key topic. So this gives us, again, I think, four key reasons for engaging with media, with mainstream media, as opinion writers. And before going into six different case studies, three from each of my good friends here, it's helpful, I think, to just understand, what do we mean by opinion pieces? Okay, opinion pieces may be at least two things here. One is the editorials, that is, written to represent a publication, often a newspaper or a magazine or whatever it is. So it's being, you know, it's actually the official representation of a media house or a media outlet. And that may be written by just one or two people, or by a group of people. And we'll come back to that. The other type of opinion piece is usually called op-ed pieces. And originally that comes from the time when you had the editorial on one side, and then you had the opposite, the editorial page. You had opinion writers being invited to contribute in a column or as a commentator. So nowadays, I think most people would not think about opposite the editorial page, but opinion as the op there. And then today, it's a page or a section of a newspaper where varying opinions are expressed by columnists, commentators, etc. This just gives us some background, and I've included on this slide from, you know, it was just taken, I could take any kind of newspaper here, but this was The Guardian, who then, in their menu, I've chosen to highlight the opinion. And there you see there are, under the opinion, you have the Guardian view highlighted here, which are the editorials. Then you have columnists, which then refers to what we call the op-eds. And then you have, interestingly enough, in a new media age, you have opinion videos. And then you have letters to the editor. And of course, letters to the editors carry somewhat lighter weight often in the public opinion than those who are invited or have a regular place in a column or as a commentator. So anyway, these are the two types of things. And the interesting thing is that our two friends here represent the two different alternatives here. Stefan, to start with you here, you represent, in this case, you're one of the persons writing editorials. You're commissioned to write editorials from what is in Swedish beautifully called Världen idag. So that means?
It means the world today.
So that's a Swedish Christian daily newspaper. And how would you describe that newspaper, Stefan?
It is an evangelical newspaper. In Sweden, there are two major Christian newspapers, one with a longer history, which gradually have become broader in its theological views, I would say, and then a younger one, and that is the World Today.
So it's younger, it's called The World Today. Okay, maybe that's one of the reasons. We're going to highlight three different examples, and I will also invite Espen if you have any comments on the way here. So the first example, if we could get an overview of all the three first. The first example being an article or an editorial wrote on this deconstructing the secular critique of the resurrection. The second one, showing the connection between an unrealistic view of the human being and the current problems within the Swedish educational system. And the third one, on the whole question about norm criticism and how do we relate to that and to the number of letters that are in LGBTQAI+. One has to keep one's tongue straight there. Of course, these reflect different aspects of the four reasons we highlighted a bit earlier. So, but let's go into the first example here, which is, this is the how it was represented, the picture and the title. And the title says, the professor in this major broadsheet newspaper in Sweden is completely wrong about the resurrection of Jesus. That's the title. The professor is completely wrong. I would say that's a fairly clearly expressed title, isn't it, Stefan?
It's a clickbait.
That's right.
Isn't it?
It's definitely a clickbait, yes. So could you give us some background here, Stefan?
Yeah. So the biggest newspaper in Sweden is called Dagens Nyheter, Today's News.
It's shortened DN.
DN. It's totally dominating the media scene in Sweden. And it has a long, long history of being very critical towards Christianity. So it's, you can say it's famous historically for its critique of the Christian faith and for promoting secularism. On Easter Day this year, when all Christians in Sweden were celebrating the resurrection of Jesus, they had a major essay on the resurrection written by a professor of history of religion at one of the universities in Stockholm. He's an interesting man. He is what we in Sweden at least call a grandchild of God. His grandfather was a leader of one of the Christian denominations. His parents were missionaries in Africa, but he himself is agnostic. And he wrote an article about the resurrection saying that the Christian faith claims that the resurrection is an actual historical true event. But that is, of course, impossible for us today to believe. And he gave a number of reasons for that, saying scientifically we know that miracles cannot happen. In terms of the sources, historical sources for the resurrection, they are unreliable and not worthy of taken seriously. And then he, instead of then ending, saying, so don't think about this anymore, he made the existential point of saying these stories can still help us. They can create hope. They do something with us when we read them. And he took his own life as an example. He had gone through a period of depression and then come out with a more, he came out in the light again. And there were different things helping him in that process. And texts like this can have this kind of function in a person's life of helping us to see light, to feel hope. So just a subjective existential meaning of the text.
So then saying there is no factual basis for the belief in the resurrection, but that it could give us subjective meaning at some level. Mm-hmm. So, and then you responded by this clearly expressed title and then the content. And how did you respond in the text?
I began by underlining a number of positive sides at his essay. It was beautifully written. It was, in terms of literature, powerful. And I enjoyed reading it for those reasons. But then I deconstruct his arguments for why he dismissed the factual or the truth of the resurrection. So looking at his view of science, which is of course a totally misconception of what science is, science cannot tell us anything about miracles. Science can only tell us about nature, that nature is it's regular, there's law. And of course, according to nature, a dead person cannot come back to life. But Christians had never claimed that, very oddly, nature threw back a dead body into life. Our claim is that God, the creator of nature, raised Jesus from the dead. And science cannot deny that. So I helped the reader to understand the misconception of science and that the resurrection of Jesus is still a possibility. And secondly, I looked at how he argued in relationship to the source material and could show that he has a very outdated view on the Gospels. He was relying on views of the Gospel that was common in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, but is totally abandoned today in modern New Testament scholarship, where the Gospels are presented as belonging to the genre of Greco-Roman biography, containing real historical information.
In this case, then, you could also rely on the fact that you had written one of your books is actually on this topic as well. So in, you know, there would be further validation possible, you know, beyond your text, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was helpful that I that I knew quite a lot.
Yes.
Within this area. So I had a number of other arguments that are really valid and strong if he would come back, so to speak, in the discussion.
Espen, a reflection, comment.
I really like that we start with this article and this topic because the topic for our workshop is writing in mainstream media. And I would suggest that some of the least controversial thing to do as a Christian is to write about the crucifixion the resurrection in the media. So I would say that anyone that have some interest in trying to present the gospel should use the possibility around Easter, because there are so often an essay, a TV program, something about a new hypothesis about what really happened in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And it could be wild and it could be all sort of things. But it gives really a possibility for Christians to say something about the truthfulness and the possibility and the importance.
And then, of course, we touch on the possibility of commenting on something and bring a perspective into the whole public square. So yes, it's a good place to start.
Did he answer the professor anything?
No.
And the context here, of course, being a Christian daily newspaper, and his original article written in the major newspaper broadsheet, at least. So there is something here about the different context, but there is a place for so many different things, not just one thing. So let's then go to a very different case study. We'll come back to some of this when we share together in a Q&A afterwards. But this, Stefan, is a very different example. And we talked about, when we prepared this together, we talked about the importance of showing both the possibility of commenting or contributing on the heart of the Christian faith, the key elements, the key content of the Christian faith, but also relating to something that is happening in the public debate and present a Christian perspective on that. And could you tell us, what is this? What is the building we are seeing here?
This is one of the few really world-class universities in Sweden. This is an elite university, Stockholm School of Economics. It's on the top lists in the world in terms of schools of economics. So there's a lot of... we are very proud of this school. Now, there was an alarming report from this school. They noticed that it's of course only students with absolute top grades that are accepted into the school, but those students, they lack in knowledge. Their grades are not reflecting their knowledge. And the reason is that the schools in the Swedish school system, they now have started to give too high grades to students in order to attract other students, and through that process the school receives more money. It's a result of a very naive deregulation of the educational system, putting it much more into a kind of market economy system, and in this case it has had these effects. And now this elite school is saying, we are not going to use the general grades any longer. We are forced to have our own testing to see which students that should be accepted. So that's it's a big crisis for the educational system in Sweden.
So then the title says, the alarm from this university is a warning for the whole of Sweden. That's what the title says. And you know it's the facade there reminds me, who comes from Uppsala, of course, of the university library in Uppsala. So it's a sort of a prestigious place, you know. And then you says, this showing the connection here between an unrealistic view of the human being and the current problems within the Swedish educational system. So you touched on that, Stefan, that you said this indicates, it shows a naive view of the human being. What is the, how did you then connect that to the Christian worldview, the Christian perspective, the Christian view of human beings?
So, one option would, of course, be to directly discuss in an editorial this problem. But I wanted to zoom out to put it in some perspective before I discuss this concrete problem. And I choose to start with a very, I think, funny story. A thing I experienced, my wife and I, together with our grandchildren, we went to a museum in Stockholm with our grandchildren. It was a museum for about toys. And you could put your clothing and bags into a locker, but there were no, you couldn't lock the thing. And then it said, when you buy the ticket, you will receive a padlock, so you can lock it. Okay, great. So I went and bought my tickets and said I would like to have a padlock. Oh, sorry, we have run out of them. They are stolen, all of them. We're waiting for a new delivery. And I thought, what a hypocrisy. People want a padlock to lock their things so no one can steal them. And when they leave the museum, they steal the padlock. That's an illustration of human nature. And then, since it's Sweden, I said, in the Swedish context, we are quite aware nowadays that within the welfare system, if there is a possibility to misuse it, a lot of people will misuse it. It's human nature. But in some other areas, there's such a naivety, and this is an example, with the deregulation of the educational system, that's such a noble thing as education. They would never misuse a system where you can get more money. So I could drive home the point of this is actually an issue of our view of human beings, of our anthropology. And here the Christian faith comes in very beautiful in explaining us as the image of God and fallen into sin. And we cannot have this naive view of the human being, not even in relationship to the educational system. And then I comment on this concrete situation.
So in a way, this was a way of both commenting on the wider scene and then relating the Christian faith to that and talking about the relevance and the credibility of the Christian view of humanity. Any reflections from you, Espen?
Well, primarily that it's very interesting and important, I also think, that Christians try to find out what's happening in the society and can use such a, what do you call it, a normal news without any obvious connection to our faith, and then twist it a little bit so it gets relevant for ethical perspectives and worldview, in this case, on humanity. I think that is a way to show the public audience and show on the public square that our faith is relevant. It's not just about what we teach from the pulpit 11 o'clock at Sundays.
And then, of course, it helps with a good and funny story, you know, at the beginning as well. So let's go to the third example from you, Stefan. Which is about the whole area of gender and the identity, sexuality. And could you give us also the background here?
So this is a text related more directly to the Christian world. And in Sweden, as unfortunately in so many other places, there's a lot of heated debate around LGBTQ. AI plus all those issues, and too many too many churches now are changing their views on those issues. And What I wanted to highlight in this text is that in the Christian discussion, the full focus is on the L and the G, lesbians and gays. And those people who change their view, they start to affirm same-sex relationships and bless same-sex relationships. But no one says anything about the other letters, the B and the Q and the T. But at the same time, when I see their books on the cover, they say the church and LGBTQ, but they do not address the other issues. And it seems to be unaware that it is a package. So you cannot say yes to one of the letters and then reject the others. And they seem unaware that internally there's total contradiction between the different letters. So in terms of the L and the G, that is presented as a fixed identity. You are a lesbian or a gay. But B, then it's very flexible. You can move between the two poles. Q, that is not that you have, in that sense, of that kind of flexibility. It goes even deeper. You have no identity at all, but can create and recreate and recreate who you are in the queer. And then in the T, then you have a fixed inner identity that has happened to come into the wrong body. And there's no logic between those views of the human being. So then my question is, what is a Christian anthropology here? You need to describe not only we think that God blesses same-sex relationship, you need to explain a full anthropology. And I challenge those churches, tell me, how would your Sunday school material for children look in 10 years' time? Will Sunday morning in church, you challenge 5, 6, 7 years old by saying, you have to feel deep inside who you are and who you are attracted to. Maybe you have come into the wrong body. Who are you? And I say, churches are totally silent on all those issues and are just voicing the first two letters. But that's, we cannot have it like that. Come on, you need to address the whole issue.
The title here says unfaithfulness as a norm is simply an expression for selfishness.
Yeah, well, what is that about? I could use a quote from a very well-known journalist. She said that now, since we have changed our understanding of marriage and open up for same-sex marriage, there is no reasons for us why we cannot change the norm around fidelity. If we can change one thing, why can't we change the other? So she argued passionately for the right to the right for infidelity, even if you're married or live in a long-term committed relationship, because we have undermine the basic norms. So I use that as, look at the secular world. They understand what it means when we abandon the foundational norm of the male-female marriage, that there are consequences for all the other questions.
Espen, we'll come back in a minute, that these are topics, areas, a lot of these things that you also write on. But any specific comment on this?
Well, I think what this example highlights is a very important way of addressing the big topic about homosexuality, transgender movement, all that kind of stuff, because it's possible to write so many things about this. It's in the media all the time. So in one sense, I guess both Stefan and I do think a lot about well, should we try to talk about something else?
Yeah.
And how to avoid giving them impression that this is what we care about, not that much about Jesus and God and the core of our faith. This is what we would like to discuss. But so when we choose to go into this kind of debates, I think this is an example of what is really, really important, because people with a liberal view, both in the secular world and in more and more also in church, they just want to focus on this is about accepting love. And then to show, no, that's not correct. This is about a package. This is about a whole new view on identity, sexuality, norms, and so forth. I think that's helpful and necessary to comment on.
And then, of course, we are back to the why contribute, why write, and one of the reasons being wanting to clarify, that it's not just one part of it, but it's a whole package, and people address doesn't, but it's not being addressed as a whole package. And then, of course, as you say, Espen, to come into this with a constructive perspective that may generate reflection and discussion, and maybe make some people to rethink something of what they have been convinced about. So that, of course, is a very important area. But as both of you say, it's not the one that we immediately would have chosen, but it's an ongoing discussion. And should we be silent as Christians? No, we have something to say. But how to say it, what to say, and when to say becomes the key questions. Well, Espen, let's go from Sweden, move from Sweden to Norway. And then we are moving from writing editorials in a Christian daily newspaper to writing opinion pieces in as a commentator or columnist in this case, two of the leading Norwegian newspapers. And the first one is about reflecting on a public service broadcast sermon about hell 70 years ago and its effect today. And the second one is on commenting and clarifying on a TV series on gay therapy. And the third is then reflecting on the transgender debate and why people disagree. So let's go to the first one. Espen, what is the background here?
Well, the man in the photo is Ole Hallesby, probably the most known Norwegian preacher and theologian from the last century. He also wrote a book called Prayer in English, yes, that has sold millions, I think.
And it's still being sold, you know, in globally. It's, yeah, one of the spiritual classics in the evangelical movement globally.
And it's really good.
It's very good, yes.
Really good.
For example, Tim Keller, in his book on prayer, includes that book in the bibliography. So this was a prominent leader in Norway with a very, you know, a lot of influence. But something happened then in 1953.
Yes, and that's a bit sad, because he should have been known in Norway as the author of this book. But what he is mainly known about these days is a broadcast on the national radio in 1953, when he was saying very clearly that if you don't believe in Jesus, you could end up in hell tomorrow. So how do you sleep peacefully when that's the possibility? So he really tried to make people convert to Christianity, but he did so in a really brutal way, and it sparked an enormous discussion in the whole media in Norway, and he got a reputation for being a rather cruel man,
a harsh man,
trying to scare people into faith, and so forth. So when the day came, the 70-year jubilee for this this sermon, I wrote a big article, in fact, in Aftenposten, which is the biggest broadsheet paper in Norway, where I try to discuss. It says, 70 years ago, the big hell debate started in Norway. It's still affecting the Norwegian church debate, something like that. And my idea about this was trying in a careful way to explain that the topic of hell is not abandoned by Christians. In fact, there are so much in the Bible about this possibility that we have to address it somehow. I tried to say something about Hallesby realizing that he was not...
Afterwards,
that perhaps this was not that wise. It's very interesting because his son-in-law was the producer from NRK or equivalent to BBC. And he came after the sermon was held to his father-in-law saying, what do you think about those in hospitals listening to your sermon? And it made the old preacher think a lot.
So, yeah.
So my perspective, my idea, just wanted to tell the story from my angle, and then I could include more about what the Bible says about the topic and try to present a nuanced description.
And of course, the fascinating thing here is that there was this 70 years ago, which many sort of people who would know the history and story here, they would be aware of that if they were, at least they were reminded of it. But you raised the issue. You were the one who raised it publicly. And then including a soft defense of the Christian view of heaven and hell, introducing that, almost reintroducing it back into the public arena. So it shows, you know, both the fact that you have been writing for many years and have become, you know, recognized as a key, maybe the key evangelical spokesman in mainstream media, and you have this platform then that you can speak from that doesn't come from just one contribution but from many contributions over many years. So I since I'm living in Norway, I noticed some of the reactions. I read it with great appreciation, but I also noticed that people were appreciative of it, almost regardless of their theological views, because this was written in a way that helped people to understand what the situation back then and the effects, and for example, differing between the arena and the theology, you know. This was like preaching as if it was a revival meeting, but a public service broadcasting is a different kind of arena. So how do you treat a theological subject which is so sensitive in a public service context?
And of course also the context is that Norway is very liberal when it comes to theology, at least public theology. The Norwegian Lutheran Church, there are not many bishops or priests talking about hell, no matter what, how. So just raising the topic and showing what Jesus has said about the reality, I thought that was worth doing.
Yeah. Stefan, a reflection here?
My general reflection is that Espen has shown a lot of courage during a number of years to discuss very sensitive issues, but have done in such a good way So you have survived, and you have been given continued place within the mainstream secular media in Norway. So that's a rather unique thing. Very few people would come away alive after an article on hell. But you have done it. So it's a really good example of the possibility of communicate as a Christian in a highly secular context, and communicating also in relationship to really difficult and sensitive topics.
And it's like the other side of the resurrection, mm-hmm. which was addressed in a Christian daily newspaper with even a conservative theology. Here, Espen is addressing hell in a major newspaper context with a very liberal agenda. So, but it shows, as you said, the possibility. So, as you understand, we could have spent time on each of those case studies, extensive time, but the point is to give the overview and to see how there are different... There are so many possibilities here, and we need to encourage people to engage in the public arena, to cultivate writing skills, to cultivate also the responsibility that someone should be able to respond at key points. And of course, then we have this example, Espen, which is from the last example was Aftenposten, which literally means the Evening Post. And this is from VG, which is called the Way, which means the way the world goes. It's not a very good translation, but it's a strange expression in the first place as well. So anyway, and this, the title here is Hegseth, which is a journalist, and you'll tell in a minute who is, his unfair method. Well, here you are in a picture, and it's obviously a television program. So what is this, Espen?
Yeah, this is very different. And I should highlight that also that this is a response.
Whereas the last one was you taking initiative, being proactive.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is a very big difference. It's normally much easier to get a place in the media if you respond to something, especially if someone is attacking you personally or your organization or something like that. You are entitled to respond. And this was the situation here, but that also means you have a more limited possibility to do what you like to do. In this situation, VG had presented a TV series, a documentary, from or with Morten Hegseth called Gay Therapy. He is a secular gay activist and a journalist, mostly dedicated to celebrity news. And I was participating in this documentary. That was tough. We debated the documentary extensively on different platforms.
Afterwards.
The problem for me to see was that he was accusing me and a lot of other people for doing gay therapy. And his view on gay therapy was that even though you just say to a gay person, if you want to live a dedicated Christian life, you either have to marry the opposite sex, and if that's not a possibility for you, then celibacy, then living alone. That is by definition of Hegseth, gay therapy, because you say to a person, you cannot be fully yourself. And that is saying to a person, you have to change, you have to not express, you have to suppress who you are. And I said that it's not fair. Gay therapy should be more limited. It's about changing orientation. So this was my perspective in that article. And it's a lot more, or it's more harsh somehow, this article, than the last one, because I have to respond to accusation that feels.
And the level of the accusations are very high, you know, very, very, it's very forcefully expressed from Hegseth and others. So then one need to respond also forcefully, but remembering to be fair, of course, in the way one argues, but still there is something there, yeah. So is there anything else you would like to highlight before I ask Stefan to comment?
No, I think that's fine.
Stefan?
I think this illustrates one of the big challenges we have today, and that is that the secular world has their definitions, and they a number of time impose their definition on things upon us, and a lot of their criticism is not actually valid, and they are unaware often. So I'm not accusing them of being dishonest, but more they have not understood the position they are criticizing, and therefore this kind of analysis and making distinctions is so important. Our time, at least in these Scandinavian countries, is not a very philosophical time. Philosophy is very much about making distinction to gain clarity in order to have an issue understood. That's not much of that in our time, and that causes so much of the confusion. So therefore, this is really a key thing.
And we could just say, perhaps, that this TV series came out because Hegseth and a lot of other people wanted to forbid to have a criminalization of gay therapy. And this was in 2019, and now we are almost 4 years later, and we're waiting these days, in fact, that the government will present some kind of criminalization. So the part of my motivation also was trying to weigh in the discussion to avoid a bill that would be really limiting the possibility of giving Christian advice, simply.
So there is element here of thinking long term and not just short term.
That's
what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I know also from your work, Stefan, in Sweden and beyond, that you've also been very concerned about not just contributing because of short-term effects, but because of long-term significance. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right. The freedom issues are extremely important, and there are strong forces that want to limit religious freedom, freedom of speech, in our countries, under the names of, they are arguing out from the human rights of a certain group, but then ignoring that they are shutting down what is true human rights of other groups. So we really need to take those issues clearly to keep Western countries actually open in terms of religious freedom, and including our freedom to also publicly express what is our convictions.
One could also express this as the freedom to do mutual critique.
Yeah.
And not just one way, the one that is politically correct, for example. Okay, we're moving into the final case here, and that's also you, Espen, which is about transgender. And what's the background here?
Well, the background is a law back in 2015, I think, about the possibility in Norway for changing legal gender. I was pretty involved in that discussion. I was somehow alone, the only one almost problematizing this kind of law. But it's interesting in Norway that today there are many more people, doctors and others, not with a Christian view, that is critical to the transgender ID that gender is about self-identifying feelings, so to speak. Since I had been involved in these debates, I thought that I could write an article about why is it getting more and more and more polarized, because that's the situation in Norway. And this is an article about more and more polarized or uforsjonlig. What's that in English?
Right. It's I think we should express it the other way, as you said. So it's the polarized gender debate.
Yeah. Or heated.
The very heated gender debate. So the point you're trying to describe why people disagree on that?
Yeah.
And why?
And I try to show in the article that it's very difficult to make peace in that debate because the core convictions are so different. For someone, the core conviction is gender is about biology, deeply said. That's my view. And for others, it's not about biology. That's a minor issue. And then it's there is no other way than it will be polarized. So I tried in this article to present myself as a very balanced man, trying to look at both sides. And that was, of course, some kind of a tactical way of trying to show that although I'm a Christian, I'm not the one polarizing these debates. That's other people doing. I'm trying to understand what's going on.
So, being the voice of common reason.
Exactly.
Yeah? Exactly, yes. Yeah. So, Stefan, any final comments before we move into some Q&A?
This whole debate about the trans ideology, it's a difficult debate, but I also see it as an interesting example of where the a debate, including with the Christian voices, actually can change the course of the discussion. That is more obvious in Sweden than in Norway, surprisingly, because for a long time the general debate in Sweden just ran with the secular and the pride movement's interpretation of things. But then a number of people started to questioning that. And one of the voices, one of the main voices was a Christian voice, the leader of the Swedish Evangelical Alliance. And then doctors and psychologists joined. And in Sweden, actually, the push for this ideology has stopped. And things are going in the other direction. So this is one of the few areas where we see the secular agenda actually being rolled back, not as far as we would like to, but at least some steps. So it's a very encouraging example in a very difficult within a very difficult issue.
And it seems also that we see something of the same tendency in Norway now, as you indicated, Espen. There is a more openness towards voicing criticism.
Yeah, it is, and it's not only Christian voices. There are other voices, especially very lesbian feminists, mostly that are the most aggressive parts, feeling that feminism is at stake if gender is not about women by birth, women as a biological category.
So thank you both, and we have spent some time now trying to outline the six examples and to give you the framework for that. I think part of what we have been trying to introduce as for further reflection for each one of us is there is a space for so many contributions and different contributions according to different gifts and talents and passions. But there is also a need, as we've talked about in another context here, the need to respond quickly if there is something going on.